Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. The thread question is up later in the hour, but first we're in depth on repairing America.
America has spent approximately $6 trillion in the Middle East. All the while, our infrastructure at home is crumbling. With the $6 trillion, we could have rebuilt our country twice.
The president wants billions, perhaps as much as $1 trillion, to fix our roads and bridges, water pipes, ports, the electrical grid. In a community that saw a bridge collapse, we know about the consequences of ignoring needed fixes. But here's some economic context on why this matters. When we sit in traffic jams, we waste time and money to the tune of more than $5 billion a year. When goods are coming in or going out of our ports and they clog up because they're slow to automate, companies ship to other places. And when experts recently assessed how far we've let our electrical grid infrastructure deteriorate, they estimated the need for more than $100 billion in investment by 2020 to keep the grid going efficiently. So that's a lot of money, and that's some context around why we're having this conversation. One more thing. The Center for Transportation Excellence reports that when voters weigh in on ballot initiatives to pay higher fees or taxes for infrastructure, a majority of those ballot measures pass. So why does it appear that President Trump's call for significant investment in infrastructure faces a very uncertain future, including among his fellow Republicans? Our guests are going to explain that. I'd like to hear from you. If your member of Congress was willing to vote for a higher gas tax or cuts somewhere else in the national budget to boost infrastructure spending, would you support that? So would you tell your member of Congress, yes, I support that, even if it means higher taxes, higher fees? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. David Levinson is with us. He's chair of transportation studies at the U of M, headed to the University of Sydney with me in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Barry LePatner is with us. He's the author of Too Big to Fall, America's Failing Infrastructure and the Way Forward, and he's with us today from New York City. And Barry, welcome to you. It's good to have you here.
Good to be with you, Carrie, this morning.
So, David, I think when we bounce into a pothole or we sit in traffic, that's probably our most personal experience with failing infrastructure. But I want you to talk a little bit about the deterioration that we may not be aware of day to day and why it's urgent.
Well, there are a number of bridges in the United States, estimates as many as 60,000, that are structurally deficient. And that means that not that they're going to fall down tomorrow necessarily, but that if they are not properly maintained and repaired over the next few years, they should be shut down, not today, not tomorrow, but eventually. And that bill is coming due. These are bridges, many of them, for instance, on the Interstate Highway Program that were built 50 years ago. They're reaching the end of their useful life, and time has come to radically repair them or replace them. And we know this is coming, and we haven't budgeted enough money to do this properly.
Forgive me for saying this, but when you say, not today, not tomorrow, that's just kind of more license to push this out further. And we've been pushing it out further for years and years and years, right?
Right. And people in politics seem to need a crisis in order to get anything done. And, you know, the expression, never let a crisis go to waste. But if you've got this drip, drip, drip of slowly eroding systems, which is what this is, very rarely do you have a tragic occurrence of a massive bridge collapse like we had in 2007 here. You sort of get this problem that it's not urgent.
Right.
It's important, but not urgent. And so people try to create an urgency about it, and you take a bridge collapse, which was caused by a number of things, but maintenance wasn't the foremost cause of the 2007 bridge collapse. It was, I mean, the bridge was designed improperly, and nobody caught it. So maintenance should have probably caught that problem, but you know they were doing a number of construction practices on the bridge at the time they shouldn't have been doing. A chain of events that occurred that led to that particular case. And we don't see that happening very often. And even when that happens, well, I mean, from a benefit cost perspective, is that the most urgent question? I mean, as you know, we in Minnesota, I guess, are spending a lot of money and time stuck in traffic.
Right.
There are solutions to that problem that we're not willing to do.
Let me do that. Barry, David rightly says even a bridge collapse does not seem to raise. And of course, that's not the thing that should trigger the urgency. What is it going to take for people to really pay attention to this, as the president is doing? But you know he's going to have a hard time in Congress with it.
Well, first, let me respond to David's comments. I couldn't be more in disagreement with him. And no one in the state of Minnesota, of all states, should be more appalled at the dangerous state of our nation's infrastructure, especially our bridges. This collapse that occurred in August 1, 2007 in Minneapolis killed 13 people, injured another 145 people, was the result of a bridge not just being structurally deficient, which means they closed some lanes, it has fractured cracks, it has other problems, but is safe as long as they don't load it up properly. But the Minnesota Bridge, the I-35W, and 8,000 like it in our nation today are also fracture critical. They were designed without redundancy, which means they had belts on but no suspenders. And that type of bridge, which was the same as the I-5 that went over the Skagit River that fell down, the Mianus River Bridge in Connecticut, and many others that have had failures, with which are both structurally deficient and fracture critical, can fall at a moment's notice. This is not my opinion. It is the hundreds of engineers who design these bridges and who maintain them around the country who I interviewed for Too Big to Fall.
I mean, here's the reality of this, though. So you and David may disagree about how many bridges are on the precipice of collapsing, but I bet you don't disagree about what the future of a big infrastructure bill like the president wants to send to Congress is. Because Congress does not, and apparently American citizens, don't treat this urgently enough. What's your thought?
Well, as one who has spoken with many of the people in Washington, congressmen as well, I know that Congress, and it's further endorsed by the statement of Bill Shuster, who heads that congressional committee, will not raise taxes, will not use tax dollars to promote improvements and the necessary remediation of our infrastructure.
Why? Because it's bad politics, they think?
It's bad politics.
Not that it is, but that they think it is.
It's bad politics, and they believe it is. They're not going to raise the gas tax, which causes our nation to fund repairs out of general expenses, as opposed to the gas tax, which since 1957 has been in place. And because they kick the can down the road on this issue. The reason, I always say it's too big to fall, is politicians looked up at that bridge that was in danger and said, it's been here for 50 years, it'll be here until I'm out of the office. I'm not going to pay, raise taxes, risk my career to fix the underside of that bridge.
Well, let me grab a call here specifically on this gas tax to John in Burnsville. Hi, John.
Hi.
What are you thinking about the gas tax?
I would be in favor of a gas tax myself, just because it makes sense to have something like that tied to infrastructure. I would only just caution against raising it too high that it puts like an excessive burden on people. But we need to have things fixed and maintained. Otherwise, the cost goes higher and higher the longer you wait.
David, I don't want to imply that President Trump is saying he's going to raise the gas tax to pay for this trillion-dollar infrastructure, right? You don't hear that either.
No one in Congress on both parties seems interested in doing that, and those words haven't left the president's lips.
And in your view, we're going to talk about public-private partnerships in a minute, but in your view, unless you have an increase in the gas tax, how do you find this amount of money that's needed for this kind of infrastructure investment?
Well, I mean, let me say first that the gas tax or a highway user fee of some kind is probably the best way to do something like this. What the Democrats are looking at is capturing money from corporate profits that are being held overseas and haven't been repatriated to the U.S., hoping that if they can reform the corporate tax code somehow, then a bunch of money will come from say, Apple Computer's profits in other countries, bring it back to the U.S., pay a lower tax rate, but then channel that tax money into an infrastructure plan. And the president is proposing to cut taxes in order to build more infrastructure.
And do you believe, do you buy that logic of finding that amount of money in that method?
I think it's possible that you can get some amount of money from that method. I'm not a macroeconomist and don't know how much corporate taxes will come in as a result of some change in the tax code. I mean, I think that there's a lot of money, but it's a one-time sum of money is the important thing to keep in mind. So this might provide a one-time infusion into infrastructure, such as just as we did in 2009 with the Recovery Act.
Right.
But it's not sustaining. And then the question is, well, how much can you do with this one-shot infusion? It's going to cost, I mean, when you do this all at once rather than spreading it out over time, you're going to pull a bunch of people into the construction sector who don't have the training in road construction or bridge construction, try to get them up to speed on that. And then 2 years later, 3 years later, when the money runs out, then they have to diffuse back through the economy. It'd be much better to have a smaller number of people working full time doing this over a longer period of time, so you don't have this spikiness in the investment. It doesn't drive up costs as much. You've got construction equipment. Where's this construction equipment otherwise going to be deployed? President Trump is also proposing to build a wall between Mexico. This is a massive infrastructure project that's going to require a lot of construction workers and equipment.
You've just raised a really good point that I wanted to take to Barry. Barry, I mean, we heard about a lot of shovel-ready projects in the stimulus in 2009. Why didn't a lot of this infrastructure get repaired then?
The real amount of money that went into real transportation and infrastructure projects was infinitesimal in 2009. Again, the Congress refused to raise taxes, refused to see that when we're talking about infrastructure, we're talking about an investment, not an expense. In the times from the 1950s on, when we built the interstate highway system, the United States incurred what we would consider a huge amount of debt, government debt. Government debt is paid out at almost interest-free cost over 25 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. It becomes an incremental cost of government. But when we start to deal, as you want to talk about, with asking public-private partnerships, private money to come in to infrastructure to the tune of $100 billion a year sustainable, there will be an imposition on the American public for that, because the bottom line of that is you're going to end up giving hefty subsidies and guaranteed profits to private interests, because otherwise they won't make the investment.
This is good. So Barry, let me remind everybody what we're talking about, and then we'll dig in on that. David Levinson is with us from the University of Minnesota, where he's chair for transportation studies, and Barry LePatner is with us. He's the author of Too Big to Fall, America's Failing Infrastructure and the Way Forward. And we've asked them to join us this morning to talk about something that President Trump talked about last Tuesday, a week ago today, when he gave his speech and he talked about wanting to invest in infrastructure. This is something that he talked about a lot on the campaign trail. He's mentioning $1 trillion. We're asking our guests this morning about where the most urgent need is. How do you pay for it if you don't raise taxes? And then there was a mention of this public-private partnership. So if you have thoughts, opinions, questions about an increased gas tax, details about this public-private partnership, here's the number on that. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, where Anthony says Trump's plan should be supported if it uses public-private partnerships. Our tax money, our infrastructure, not corporations' cash cow. David, when I think of public-private partnerships, I think of things like toll roads, where somebody else comes in, bears the cost on the front side of it, and then makes the investment back as taxpayers want to use that road. Is that just like a small example of a much larger idea?
Yeah, and I mean, most toll roads aren't public-private partnerships in the U.S., but some of the newer toll roads are, and that's one example. The I-394 toll lanes, express lanes, are a public-private partnership. But there's other types, and many of things like design-build, where you select a firm that will both design the infrastructure and then build the infrastructure and design, build, operate, and maintain, and then have a contract to operate and maintain the infrastructure over a long period of time to some standard, which could be paid back via tolls from the users, or it could be paid back by the government in exchange for providing this service, are various types of public-private partnerships. You could deal with using land grants or land value as a way of inducing the private sector to provide infrastructure.
Giving them access to valued land.
Right, allowing them to develop around, I mean, if they build a road, giving them the land to also develop around the interchanges on the road that they're building. There's a proposal in Australia, for instance, to build a high-speed rail line between Sydney and Melbourne. It's not clear whether this will actually happen. It's been proposed for a very long time. But this very fast train, as they call it, is proposed to be paid for by a series of eight cities around the high-speed rail stations along the line. And the proponents of the line, the private firm that's proposing the line, claims it will pencil out. And if they can convince the government that it will, then they might get the right-of-way and permission to do such a—
When you say pencil out, you mean cover all the costs.
Cover the capital costs of the line. Okay. And then the operating costs would be paid for by the users of the line, the people who are riding the train. And so we did this in the United States back in the 19th century when we gave enormous land grants to the railroads.
Yeah.
And those land grants built the American West and provided the railroads enough money to help pay for the costs of building the speculative transcontinental railroads in the first place.
So, Barry, can you leverage this idea of public-private partnerships to the scale, I guess, of what's needed for infrastructure?
There's a place, Kerry, for public-private partnerships in rebuilding our nation's infrastructure. But we have to be very careful in one sense. If we do a rush to privatize resources such as our roads, our bridges, our public utilities, what we are doing is giving up the public's rights to those facilities for a period of 75 to 99 years at times. And in doing so, you are giving a built-in profit for an investment. That investment comes along with tax credits. It is not a free lunch for the American public. Everybody must understand that there is a give and take on each of these negotiated deals. And the give and take means that invested dollars are going to get tax credits as opposed to someone building or the government building a facility and keeping it in the public domain.
Yeah, I would think a number of Minnesota taxpayers are familiar with the kind of tax increment financing that goes on at the state capitol and some of the tax credits that you're talking about. This is not unusual. They build stadiums like this. They build other public institutions like this, don't they?
And the value has always been proven on the stadiums and similar projects to have been a huge benefit to the private interests who put that money up.
Do you agree with that, David?
Case.
Well, in the case of stadiums, yes. In the case of roads, it's a mixed bag. There's been a lot of public private partnerships or privately financed toll roads that have in fact gone bankrupt. So the public sector got the benefit of the investment, and the capital investors, private capital investors, got their capital wiped out in part or in whole. The most famous example of this is probably the Indiana Tollway, which was a publicly owned toll road in Indiana. It was sold off to international private consortium just before the Great Recession. They put a lot of money into the road. They raised tolls. But the revenue that they got wasn't enough to pay for the cost of operating the road.
And the taxpayers kind of got a good deal.
And the taxpayers got a not terrible deal out of that. The good thing about these kinds of infrastructure, unlike, say, other types of capital, where if it doesn't go well, you can pick up the equipment in the factory and move it to China. You can't pick up the road and move it. So it's not going anywhere. And so even if the investors get wiped out, we still get the service of the road in an ongoing basis. So there's a little bit less risk here than there would be in some other types of examples.
Josh says on Twitter, public-private is fine if it doesn't become a toll road scenario. To the phones here to Eric in Chanhassen. Hey, Eric, your question.
Hi. My question is
since raising taxes is clearly not an option, would reducing the mileage credit for businesses on their vehicles that they use on the road, so I'm thinking like truck drivers who might drive thousands of miles, if that got reduced from, I think it's 57 cents a mile to say 40 cents or 45 cents, would that create like a substantial amount of money?
Barry, what do you think of that?
Well, we're going in the wrong direction here. We have to look at the long-term implications of remediating our transportation. This is not a sprint, it's a marathon for our nation. And when we impose a gas tax, when we put any kind of imposition on how we charge for the use of our facilities, what we're saying is that those who use it are going to pay for the right to support it, because it's not just the building of that system, it's the maintenance as well, which over a term of 40, 50, 60 or more years is a huge cost expense to the nation. So across the spectrum of our roads, our bridges, our dams, our utilities, we have to factor in how we're going to fund maintenance into this. Now, when you have a public-private partnership, the careful analysis of that by each state and the federal government must factor in whether there's going to be enough profits from tolls that are going to support ongoing maintenance. In the Indiana situation, they did not do that computation properly, and when they couldn't make enough of a profit, they folded that special vehicle interest, which is the corporation that takes the lease. We can't afford to remediate our properties going forward and not factor in maintenance, and that's why we can't start thinking about reducing the role of ongoing expenses of those who use the facilities.
Okay. Michelle in South Dakota says, I'd be willing to pay extra, but only if the government can show they'll use it in a responsible way. And this is what always comes up at the state capitol, as you know, David, when we have a debate about this. And we're getting some questions on Twitter, and I think a call here about, we've been spending a lot of time talking about roads and bridges, but there's a lot of other infrastructure that I mentioned in the introduction. So to Linda in Oakdale, Linda, what are you interested in?
Well, I have a comment and a question. Thanks
okay.
for listening to me. I worked in the wastewater industry for nearly 36 years, and I'm curious, every time we talk about infrastructure, it goes to roads and bridges. We have problems with water accessibility, water quality, and I think you need to talk with the person who's been exposed to something like that to understand how critical one day without water out of our taps can be.
Okay.
So,
Yeah, Linda, I think we've got the essence of that. You know, David, I know your expertise is actual transportation, right? But you acknowledge that what we're saying about transportation infrastructure applies to this other stuff,
I
too.
Mean, all of the infrastructure systems that we've built in the U.S. are aging, and the water systems in our cities especially are built more than a century ago, there needs to be an investment. Now, there is an appropriate question as to where should that investment come from? Is this a federal problem or a state or a local problem? And I think there's a case to be made that most of this infrastructure is locally serving and should be paid for by states or locals rather than going to Washington. You're closer to the problem, you understand the problem better, and you understand the urgency of the problem better if you're closer to it. But as long as the federal government's handing out money, people are going to want to get the federal money first. It's logical to try to do that. And I think that's part of the problem that we have is we're debating local issues as if the federal government should come up with a magic solution
right.
when we can't even come up with a local solution for our own problems.
Hey, Barry, a question for you, too. And I think this covers a lot of different infrastructure. Do you think infrastructure construction projects would move along more quickly if we were able to streamline the environmental review process? And I ask that because I was reading an article about this in The Atlantic, and the reporter used Germany as an example. Germany's a very green country, as you know, with high environmental standards. But here's what the article said. Yet it does environmental review in a year, not a decade. Germany is able to accomplish both review and permitting in less than 2 years by creating clear lines of authority.
There's no doubt that there is an enormous inefficiency in the way we permit and approve construction projects at the local, the city, the state, and the federal level. And that is one of the impediments that we have. It can be addressed, but it has to be addressed smartly. The issue for water, for dams, the issue for many of our infrastructure issues like ports are no longer local issues. They become regional issues. And what I've spoken around the country, what I've talked to leaders in the transportation world, in the infrastructure world, is the recognition that when we address these problems, they are interstate in nature. And we can no longer treat them on an individual basis as a state issue or a city issue. I've been calling for an infrastructure czar, someone who can cross the boundaries of today's structured political hierarchy, be given the authority to pull together resources from regional basis so that decisions can be made for the long term.
Barry, David does not seem to go along with that idea of the infrastructure czar. Why not, David?
Well, I think you have this problem of we have a political process that's designed to resolve things that people don't agree upon. And if we don't agree on the problem, why would appointing someone to solve this magically satisfy that? We're still not going to agree on this. And you're giving somebody power who's unelected. And the best example of an infrastructure czar is a Robert Moses of New York, who famously rebuilt New York, built the parkway system in New York, built a lot of parks in New York, and was for a time much beloved by New Yorkers for doing this, but then decided to try to build interstate highways through the city of New York, and it created a lot of problems and a lot of fights because it was going to bulldoze neighborhoods for the greater good. So we have political processes for a reason, and if we can't agree, maybe we shouldn't be doing something. We should figure out, well, what do we need to come to an agreement? Rather than just trying to solve our problem with a monarchy.
And what do you think of this environment, streamlining the environmental review process?
And I think that there might be something to be said for streamlining the environmental review process, but you got to remember at the end, the bottleneck is the money, right? So even if we got all of the processes through environmental review faster, we still only have so much money to spend. And unless we increase the amount of money we're going to spend, we're not going to be producing more projects on the outer.
That's a good point, Barry, which brings us back to the money, which is where we started. And so I want to ask you both what you think President Trump will end up getting from Congress for infrastructure.
The statement this past week from Representative Bill Schuster, who heads the lead congressional committee that funnels the money to our nation's infrastructure, has made it clear there will be no tax money used for the president's infrastructure program. If it's not going to be done through private money, he said, then it's not getting done. And that's why we lack the political will and the political leadership. And as long as that stalemate stays in place, and it looks like that's the picture from Washington for the near-term future, we are going to have continued problems with our infrastructure that are going to grow more perilous with every year.
Barry, I appreciate the time and the perspective on the show. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Good to be with you, Carrie.
David, I wish you well in Australia, where it seems like they have a more progressive transportation policy.
Well, they have a different transportation policy.
Okay.
And they have a lot more transportation policy.
You're not
policy.
Taking on my progressive. Thank you very much. Good to have your view here. Thank you.
Thank you.